Wing Commander McLean, Real One. Could you tell me how you came to join the Auxiliary Air Force, please?
I was always interested in flying. My father's younger brother was one of the first people in flying, Colonel A.C.H. McLean. I was aware of the rise of Hitler, and I knew in my bones that sooner or later we should be called upon in this country to clip his wings. And it struck me that flying was something which was coming, and I might perform a public duty and also acquire a modern skill at the same time. So the Auxiliary Air Force seemed to be an ideal vehicle for achieving those two objects. That's what put me into it. But I was keen, as I was telling you before, I took my university degree, Bachelor of Law at Glasgow, but I decided there was too much to it, so I waited until I got the degree in 1935, and then I was accepted for the 602 Squadron under the command of the Marquess of Clydesdale, who later became the Duke of Hamilton. He had been a pilot who'd flown over Mount Everest, if you may remember. A famous figure at the time.
Did you get to know him well?
Well, as a very junior officer, I knew him as well as any of them did. In fact, there's reference to him in the account of Hesse's arrival, which I told you about.
Yeah. What kind of a man was Hamel, Duke of Marquess of Clydesdale?
Oh, absolutely charming, rather vague, but delightful man, just enough sternness in him to make him a good commanding officer, but I remember going to camp with him under his command, and he took me along with him to buy a new aeroplane in a factory down in the south of England, and when I got home after camp, my mother said, where's your raincoat? I said, my God, I left it in the Marquess's aircraft. This was way back in July, I think it was, and I went and picked it out of the aeroplane in October. So it shows you what sort of vague sort of chap he was. He had this foreign raincoat in the back of his aeroplane all those months.
Was he a good pilot himself?
Oh, very good, yes. He wasn't. He wasn't a frightfully good instructor. I had one or two hours with him as an instructor, but curiously enough, he was rather peppery as an instructor. But it wasn't his long suit. But he was a good pilot, yes. And of course, he got too senior. He retired about 19, I suppose. He retired at the end of 36 and was succeeded by D.F. McIntyre, who was a famous figure in Scottish aviation. D.F. McIntyre was an auxiliary, a stevedore profession. And McIntyre, while he was with us, founded Prestwick Aerodrome. The Marquess, between them, I think it was, started Prestwick. I don't know the ins and outs of Prestwick, but they were the leading figures in it, and they set up a flying training school, because at that time the RAF was getting very worked up, the country was getting worked up about Hitler at last, and they were setting up flying training schools, and they did one at Prestwick, and that was its first big role. That was Prestwick. Anyway, that McIntyre, he was the second pilot on the Everest flight. He flew the other machine. And then after that it was Douglas Farker, who was a stockbroker in Glasgow. He took us into the war in 1939, Douglas Farker. He was a very experienced auxiliary pilot, squadron leader. And so as we started the war with him, and the flight commanders were, I think I'm right in saying, was George Pinkerton, B flight, and Marcus Robinson was the flight commander of A flight, two flights. But I was in A flight. John Dunlop Urey and Donald Jack. I don't know who the others were there. Of course, it'll be in the records as to who they all were, these squadron pilots. And I was in the office early in August, and I was staying at the down at Abbotson's at the aerodrome when my parents were away on holiday. And I got back out of the office, and I was greeted by the assistant adjutant saying, How do you like being in the RAF? I said, I'm not in the RAF. I'm an auxiliary. I said, well, you were since 3 o'clock this afternoon. So that's that. My brother was in Germany as a student. He's here today. And he'd written a letter to my mother saying, Mother said, come home for heaven's sake. There's going to be a war. And he said, he wrote back saying that those on the spot knew best. So I had to send him a telegram to wherever he was, near Frankfurt, I think, saying, I'm in uniform, for heaven's sake, come home. And he got out with an hour to spare.
Otherwise he would have been interned.
That's it, yeah.
You were telling me earlier that the amount of flying which was required in the Auxiliary Air Force.
Yeah.
Can you repeat what you were telling me earlier?
Well, the Auxiliary Air Force, because of the flying commitment, required a very much bigger attendance record than was expected from the Territorial Army. We had to do 3 weekends a month. We got 1 weekend off, and two evenings a week flying from about after the office, from about five, and then one evening a week at town headquarters in the winter. So that took the whole of your spare time. And of course there was a summer camp, a fortnight. The squadron was, she would be trained as a unit, not as individual chaps. We had not only officer pilots, but we had a complete quota of trades, all trades, fitters, riggers, armourers, every form of trade, and the squadron numbered about 160 airmen, I think, of different sorts. And so we were a complete unit. And when we were mobilised, we went to war as a complete squadron. And that was rather interesting because just at the beginning of the war, 40% of fighter command were auxiliaries. Of course, as Britain's war effort got steam up, and fellows were trained, and of course the percentage of auxiliaries dropped. But just at the very start, when we were all expecting the balloon to go up, 40% of fighter command were auxiliaries.
How do you think the proficiency of Auxiliary Air Force pilots at that time compared with the regular RAF pilots?
Well, the experienced ones, people like Douglas Farker and Marcus Robinson and George Pinkerton, had a lot more experience than the average young regular pilot. Because they were, of course, the people of their equivalent age in the regulars, of course, were very experienced. But by the time the war started, the regular squadrons were largely filled up by very keen young chaps from New Zealand, Canada, South Africa, all kinds of places, and of course Britain in large numbers. But they were all, they were fellows who probably had two years, or perhaps two to two and a half years or 3 years service, the regulars, and they were jolly good. But they, I suppose, really, they were very much the same as the experienced auxiliaries who'd been at it rather longer. But they were, it was a question of how much time and experience you'd had. And as I say, the experienced regulars, of course, were absolutely on a class by themselves. But they were, even by the time the war started, they were in, they were kind of in flight commander level. And the average sort of junior officer in the flight hadn't got a great deal of experience.
What kind of airplanes was 602 Squadron equipped with when the war broke out?
Spitfire.
Mark 1s,
yes. We were bombers to start with, and we complained like mad that there was simply an auxiliary role in bombers was crazy. And to our amazement, the Air Minister suddenly made us Army Cooperation, which was even stupider, because it meant Army Co-op was the most, I suppose, the most technically demanding of any sort of work, because you had to know about the Army and everything else, and Morse and God knows what. We were Army Co-op for about 6 months, and then finally they saw the light, and we got gauntlets in about 1938, I suppose. And then we were very fortunate. We had an aerodrome with a long runways at Abbots Inch, so we were very fortunate in getting the Spitfires in, I suppose, March or so, 39, and we all had to sit a 3-hour exam on the Spitfire before we were allowed to fly it. And
on the technical side?
Yes. You see, we'd only flown biplanes, and that was the gauntlets. And the only aeroplane we'd flown was a Magister. And the Magisters had flaps. So that was the only aeroplane they could produce with a set of flaps to operate. There was all kinds of things to master, such as variable pitch propellers, retractable undercarriage, and a lot of new things we've never done before. And so they. Best they could. We had one machine which they sent up, a Fairey Battle, and this had these things. It had a retractable undercarriage, and it had flaps. And one of our chaps hit the flashing beak coming in at night, and smashed it up. So that knocked the training facilities on the head. So all we could do was had this this 3-hour exam, and then, having passed that, we were sat in the aeroplane and we took off and hoped for the best. And it was quite a sensation, I can tell you. I took off from Abbots Inch, and I never felt this fine and coarse pitch. Of course, it was quite different writing it in an exam paper to the feel of the thing, and I couldn't tell which I was in. And however, I got off, and by the time I'd got my wits together, I was way beyond Bear's Den.
Way beyond where?
Way beyond Bear's Den, before I could almost draw breath after this rather hairy takeoff. I managed to I pulled myself together after that and landed the thing, and so all was well.
How attached were you to the Spitfire?
Oh, it's a lovely aeroplane, no doubt about it. One realised that going to war, you had a reasonable chance in this aeroplane. What had depressed us a bit in peacetime was going to the cinema, for example, and seeing Americans flying around in things called DC-2s, I think it was, airliners, which went faster than our aeroplanes, our biplanes. And it was rather depressing to think that we were rapidly going to arriving at a state of war in aeroplanes that couldn't even go as fast as American civil passengers could fly. But as I say, this got put right when we got the Spitfires. We really felt we were going to achieve something.
Were you and your brother officers in the Auxiliary Air Force paying much attention to German developments in the Luftwaffe?
Not nearly as much as we should have done. Wasn't a great deal of information given us. In fact, looking back on it, I fault the RAF very much for not making a study of the Spanish War, which the Germans had developed a fighter tactics, and which none of the messages came to us. If they did, I never heard them. And we could have saved a lot of lives, I think, if we'd had some information about how the Huns did it in Spain.
But did you feel that the Luftwaffe were way ahead in 1939?
No. Surprising how confident we were in our own ability. Amazing confidence we had in our own ability. And I'm not sure it was very well founded, but when we went to war, we never thought we might lose it. We reckoned we'd pull it off. Of course, we had the first 2 years were pretty depressing.
When war was declared, how did you and the people round about you react? Were you depressed or
no?
What?
I'd been in an office as a very junior clerk in a law office in a very unsettled time when it was quite obvious the incompetence of the politicians for the last 15 years and had landed us in a situation which was inevitably going to lead to war, and none of the old men could see it, and it was quite obvious who the chaps were going to have to cope with it, and it was very unsettling to work in an office and flying and everything connected with the RAF was a dash sight more interesting than sitting in an office. So I was really quite pleased to leave it behind. And even then, at a slight increase in pay at 10.6 a day, or whatever it was we got, or 11 shillings.
What kind of duties did 602 Squadron take up once war was declared?
Or in a state of readiness. That was a technical word, readiness, but the idea was we were waiting for it was thought that immediate air attacks would develop from Germany. The squadron had to be, fighter command squadrons were all had various states of readiness. There was there was available 15 minutes, available 30 minutes, and I think it was readiness, which was you were supposed to be off. I can't remember. I think it was supposed to be about 2 minutes, but in the air, and stand by where you're sitting in the thing. Certain number of us were always at readiness. But shortly after we were mobilized at Abbotsinch, that was before the war, in early August, a message came through, all pilots to be injected with typhoid, paratyphoid, A and B, and cholera. And we all went to, and the doctor, squadron doc, old Alan, stuck his needle into everybody and reduced the squadron to complete shambles. The squadron, my flight commander was dragging his leg along in the tailback. We were completely hors de combat for a day. So just as well the Huns never came.
Did you do patrolling at first of convoys and that type of thing?
Well, no. What happened was we were started at Abbotsinch, Glasgow Airport. Well, it was ringed with balloons. After the war had been going for about 3 weeks, in mid-September, I suppose, they suddenly realized the best place to defend the industrial areas of Scotland was not sitting in Abbotsinch, but in the East Coast. And we were deflected off patrol, it's in that schedule there, deflected off patrol one afternoon in September, I think it was, to land at Grangemouth. And Grangemouth is now covered by a BP complex. Anyway, it was an airfield and used as a flying training place. And so we landed there, and then the following day we were ordered to Grangemouth, the whole squadron. And then Douglas Parker, we'd been the second day at Grangemouth, Douglas said to me, "Hector, I want you to go and have breakfast at Zrem." And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I want you to see if you can land a Spitfire there." And he said, "You watch it, because they got a very damp patch, a boggy patch at the bottom of the airfield. So don't go on your nose." So I went to Drem and flew over at about half past 7 in the morning, landed at Drem and went into the mess. And a magnificent peacetime flying training room, station in full blast. Everybody, they were having a marvelous time. War was, it was a marvelous station. Everything laid on well. And I was looked at with a certain amount of suspicion. And I appeared like the writing on the wall at Belshazzar's feast. I managed not to go on my nose and got back to Grangemouth. And I said, "It can be done. You have to watch it, because the thing's on a hill. It's just about the same angle as a Spitfire's gliding angle, but if you watch it, it can be done." "Oh," he said, "right, we'll move there this afternoon." And so off they went to Drem, and we landed there. And of course, there was no accommodation for the airmen or anything. And so Douglas commandeered the Marine Hotel at Gillan. And it was a marvellous effort, you know, as a young stockbroker. And then all the airmen went up there, and then Douglas went up, and he found that the Marine Hotel at Gillan that night was blazing with light, because there were no blackouts, you see. And so he said, "That won't do." He went into the, got the flight sergeant, and he said, "Now, this place is not blacked out." "Well, sir," he said, "there wasn't any blackout given us." "Oh," I said, "well, either if I come up tomorrow night and I find it unblacked out, I'm going to fire my revolver through every window." So he went back to the comfortable mess that he was living in. And so went up next night with his revolver, and the place was completely blacked out. And what the airmen had done was they cut the carpets up. That was how it was done. So that's how we arrived at Drehen. And after that we were engaged in the protecting fishing vessels and convoys down the east coast. And of course we got the odd raid too, from Germany. We raided the 4th Bridge, Rosyth Dockyard. I think the date of that is given there.
Yes, you put 16th of October 1939 there.
That's it.
Did you go up yourself to
intercept? Oh, yes, yes. We all, the squadron were ordered off, and told Turnhouse, gate. That was the expression for, you know, full blast, as fast as you could go. And we climbed up to, and then extraordinary looking in the sky, it was full of these amazing looking puffs of cotton wool. And I just didn't know what they were, these puffs of cotton wool. Of course it was ACAC fire. I'd never seen one bursting, you see. Then we arrived over the 4th Bridge, and God damn it, there was a twin-engined aircraft flying about in formation, and suddenly we realised they got crosses on them, and good Lord, the war started. So in we went and had a go, and I chased. I couldn't believe that it wasn't another mess up, because we'd been ordered off so often to intercept things, and it'd been a Blenheim or an Anson or something like that. So I couldn't believe it, and I followed them gingerly, thinking, now, last thing, I must not shoot one of our own fellows down. And the other crosses were. So finally I had a go. I had a blatter at two of them off May Island, I think.
Off which island?
Well, between Dunfermline and May Island, I was attacked them.
Did you shoot any down?
I don't think so. Well, there were certainly aircraft shot down in that area, but I never claimed. In fact, I suddenly realised, if this is the beginning of the war, I'd better get back and get some more ammunition. So I didn't stay around to watch them.